back, little helpers. So in a lot of our episodes, we talk about relationships and things like narcissism. We typically talk about disorders and how they may affect how we feel about ourselves. And so today's episode is about something that we can all relate to, because whether it's high or low, we all have self-esteem. So what is self-esteem? How do we enhance our self-esteem? Does it change over our life course? So basically, self-esteem is just how we feel about our own attributes. Kibby, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, self-esteem is not just what you are, right? It's not like skinny or fat or hardworking or not hardworking or man or woman. It's not exactly what we are, but how we feel about it. So it's really just a kind of an evaluation of ourselves.
Yeah, perfect. And we see some trends with personalities that may have higher or lower self-esteem. We see that extroversion, high conscientiousness, and basically a stable emotional state are all predictors of high self-esteem. And so obviously the converse is true for low conscientiousness, introversion, and an unstable emotional self, which kind of tracks with me because I am extroverted and emotionally stable, but I'm very low on conscientiousness, which is where all of my like low self-esteem aspects come from. But I'm generally
well, see,
high self-esteem.
That's the thing. It's interesting that those traits, we're saying that those traits link to self-esteem, but you could be an extrovert or introvert, and it's about how you feel about those things, right?
Mm-hmm.
So interesting.
I mean, I'm wondering if the extroversion aspect is, you know, if extroverts might have a strong sense of like social belonging, a lot of friends, a lot of positive feedback about the self. And so that might just be protective. But obviously many, many introverts have high self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. One thing that's interesting. So we see that self-esteem tends to increase from adolescence to middle adulthood, and it peaks around age 50 to 60. That didn't surprise me. It does seem like there's a sense of kind of security that comes in middle adulthood. But what I didn't what I didn't realize is that self-esteem actually decreases fairly rapidly after that point, which is kind of a sick joke to play on us that at the end of our lives, we might have low self-esteem. Apparently, this is moderated, though, by cognitive decline, health, and socioeconomic status. So I guess what might be happening is that if you have an elderly person who has managed to maintain their wealth, their health, and their minds, then they probably have pretty high self-esteem. But those that don't, you know, their self-esteem decreases.
I actually find those findings really relieving because, you kind of think that your early 20s or youth, when you're in your youth, that's the time when you have the most, I wouldn't say the most self-esteem, but, you know, you have the most fun, you're the most extroverted, mm-hmm. you go out, you have a lot of friends and stuff like that. And then as you get into your 30s and 40s and 50s, your life kind of, you know, mellows out a little bit. But it's interesting that the evaluation of yourself, of just like, do I like myself? Do I like who I am? Yeah. Gets better over time. So we're, you know, if you feel like you have low self-esteem now, you know, just give it some time, give it to your 50s and you're going to be like, you know, I am who I am and I don't mind it.
Yeah. And then when you're 17, 80, you can go back to the way you felt when you were a teenager. So that's fun. That's something we can look forward to.
Research is not always a silver lining. It's still the
yeah.
truth.
Yeah. Another aspect of self-esteem that's been studied is whether this is more like mood, which changes based on which context you're in, you know, what time of day it is or something like that, or if it's more like a trait, like something about your personality that's relatively stable. And what they found is it is more like a trait. So this is really interesting. It means a couple of different things. One, if you have naturally high self-esteem, you can pretty much predict that later in life, you're still going to have high self-esteem. Even if, for instance, you go through several career failures. Now, obviously, you know, that might lower it a bit, but generally we're finding that it's pretty stable. Of course, that also means that if you have low self-esteem, you might be able to predict that later in life, you will still have low self-esteem. But to make this less scary, this doesn't mean that that self-esteem is not changeable. You can change self-esteem, but that's why it's really, really important to intervene on it and intervene as early as you can, because these general, you know, population trend lines, they're not talking about patient populations that have come in and received specific interventions for self-esteem. This is just a general population. If you can intervene early, then this is something that can change.
Yeah, I feel like this is such a common thing that people come in wanting therapy for. Like, people come in really depressed or in a bad relationship or not really going for the career or the life that they want because they feel really bad about themselves. And they're like, mm-hmm. I just need to change my self-esteem. And so that is a question about, like, whether you can do that, whether we can actually change our self-esteem. And the research shows that we can. There are actually are interventions. It's just about learning about what self-esteem actually is mm-hmm. and then what things that will actually help versus do nothing.
Yeah, absolutely. And another reason to intervene on this is that we know that high self-esteem predicts success and well-being in such domains as relationships, work, and health. So it's really, really important to work on your self-esteem if this is something that you struggle with. So Kibby, can you tell us a little bit more of, like, the theory of self-esteem and what it means and how it develops, and then we can go from there to telling how to change it?
Yeah, I don't think there's just one theory of self-esteem. It's such a popular topic in social psychology research, but there's a theory of that I really like. One of our old professors who just retired, Mark Leary and Roy Baumeister, they developed a theory together called the sociometer theory of self-esteem. I really, really like this. It's very simple, but the sociometer theory basically says that self-esteem is like a gauge. It's like a meter. For how much you think that other people are going to value you. Mm-hmm. So it's about, like, how valuable are you for belongingness, belonging to the group, being well-received by others. And they're saying this because it is so important. I mean, we talk about this on the podcast all the time. It is so important for us to belong to with others, right? Belong to a group, a community, relationships. That if that's so important for, like, the human race, then it must make sense to have internal systems that monitor whether we mm-hmm. are achieving that or not, right? So if people like you, if people want to hire you, if people want to stay in a relationship with you, want to make friends with you, that it all goes into your self-esteem. So that's called the sociometer theory.
It's interesting when I'm thinking about, like, borderline personality disorder. I mean, that's a disorder where the theory is basically that they're chronically invalidated early on, which is, I mean, it works into this theory because it's basically like you come out of the womb, the people around you are telling you, like, you don't make sense to us. You don't make any sense. And so, of course, that's going to send the feedback, like, I don't belong with others. I don't, mm-hmm. I'm not desirable to others. And we know that people with BPD have really, really low self-esteem.
Yeah, and it's a really a tricky feedback loop because, especially when we talk about mental health, because if you have a childhood where people put you down, they invalidate your feelings, you have the low sociometer, you have low self-esteem that's like, I'm not wanted by others, then you're going to approach this new situation with that belief, right? With that low sociometer, you're like, people are not going to like me. And so you're going to act kind of accordingly. There's some theories of self-esteem that says people are driven to maintain their self-esteem, right? If they think to themselves, oh, I'm not worthy, people don't like me, they might go into a new social situation and kind of make that true. They become a little bit more difficult. They kind of push people away. And sometimes it's like more relieving to confirm your own self-esteem than to try to change your identity or self-esteem, the way people relate to you. So there's this kind of feedback loop about that.
It's really interesting that it's like there's something that feels more safe and just in continuity, whatever, even if it's mm-hmm. a bad continuity, than in belonging. Like, I'd mm-hmm. rather just maintain stasis mm-hmm. than belong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it happens in romantic relationships all the time, right? It sometimes could feel like, gosh, I end up with the same kind of person, right? Mm-hmm. Like, whoever I think I deserve, I'm going to get. Yeah. Some people call that law of attraction, but it really is this kind of like, we like confirming our own self-views. We like going in if thinking I'm not worthy, people treat me badly, men are going to cheat on me, you know, whatever, and then go in and try to confirm it You know, so there is a little bit of like we attract similar things, but also we sometimes like tend to make the past happen again. You know?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I can see part of that is like if something is all you know, then it's hard not to repeat patterns. You know, if all mm-hmm. you know is that men are going to abuse you, then it might not be imaginable that you could have a different relationship. So that's kind of like one hypothesis. But the other is just like, maybe I don't know how to exist in a system. I don't know how to think about myself if the things in my life aren't consistent. So yeah. if my identity is like part of that is being victimized by other people, not belonging, being treated poorly, then I almost want that to go on because otherwise I wouldn't know who I am. Or mm-hmm.
Definitely true.
That really underlines A, how important it is to treat your children with validation, respect, and kindness. And B, like if you can notice within yourself, like maybe I've been aiming for continuity instead of feeling good, instead of changing my life, then this could mm-hmm. maybe be a signal to try something new.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's also then like what do you do? Like what do you actually do to change your self-esteem? You know, mm-hmm. we get that all the time as therapists. And I think my self-esteem has actually changed quite a bit throughout my life too. So I think the sociometric theory gives us a little bit of a better insight into how you do that. Because if you've tried to, I mean, this is like tips for your loved ones, right? If you've tried to boost your friend or loved one's self-esteem by like pumping them up, being like, no, you're great. You deserve mm-hmm. better. You know, the person might feel good at the moment, but I don't know if it actually works. Like, I don't even, it might in certain ways, it might just make them feel good, which boosts their mood and makes them like kind of proactive and go towards things that feel good to them and like feel meaningful. But I don't think just the reassurance and telling them they're great is the way to go based on the sociometric theory.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the same for a lot of reassurance. It feels really good in the moment, but then it's not highly believable over time. It's very easy to disconfirm if you have a mindset where if you truly believe that you're not desired by other people, then one person says, oh, but you're awesome, you're great. It's like, okay, but my worldview is going to disconfirm that instantly because it's not what I inherently believe.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. So what should we do instead?
Well, I mean, if you think about the sociometric theory and think about, let's say, someone who's really depressed, mm-hmm. okay, so their sociometer is broken. That's when you really have issues with self-esteem, is when your meter is off, when it's like artificially too low or artificially too high, like narcissists, right? Actually, mm-hmm. narcissists might swing up and down from the too high to too low, and they're not actually getting the reality. Mm-hmm. So when you're, you know, I'm just keep thinking of people with depression. They come in to our office and they say, I need a better self-esteem. And you talk about, okay, like, how do you feel about yourself? And they say, oh, I'm just a failure. I'm just like, I got a B in my last test. I am just a failure. Now their minds are used to using different kind of cognitive distortions. Mm-hmm. So they're biased with that low sociometer, right? That's also called, you know, some of the cognitive distortions could be like overgeneralization, right? So that means if you have like one bad moment, one failure, one rejection, you're making that data point into like the thing that determines your whole sociometer, right? I got a B in my last test. I'm a failure, right? Mm-hmm. So that's taking one instance and making that color your entire evaluation of yourself, right? And that's broken because it's not actually, your sociometer should kind of gather up all your experiences and say, hey, you know what? Sometimes I failed, sometimes I did well. Mm-hmm. And I fail 20% of the time and I do well 80% of the time.
Yeah.
And that's actually how to kind of get that sociometer back working is to help that person see all of the different experiences and all of the different traits and qualities that person actually has so that they could base their self view on that, on like the reality.
Yeah. There's an intervention called like reminiscence treatments or interventions mm-hmm. where basically you either you bring up a negative memory that might be kind of fueling some of this negative self-esteem or low self-esteem, and you help them reevaluate, kind of like cognitive restructuring, but almost like cognitive restructuring around an event or around yeah. a memory. Yeah. Or you help them bring up other positive memories, because that's like, if your attention is just a spotlight on a negative memory, yep. then it's like, why don't we bring in a couple others to sort of just confirm this a little bit, or at least makes it more flexible mm-hmm. and varied.
Yeah, that's the kind of principles of CBT, is not necessarily to artificially pump up your evaluations. Like, it's not just positive thinking, right? It's actually mm-hmm. looking at the real positives in your life that you're totally discounting.
Yeah.
And what's interesting, I remember when Dr. Leary taught us about the sociometer theory, he told us about this movement in, I think it was like mostly California, but it was in the 90s. And the movement is like positive self-esteem and boosting people's self-esteem and hoping that leads to good things. Based mm-hmm. on the research, like good self-esteem leads to like good outcomes, happier life, better academic performance. So I think in the 90s, they, a lot, especially in schools, this was like child and school-based interventions where the movement is to just tell your kids, like, you're doing amazing. Give them participation awards. Just tell them they're great. They could do anything they want. And actually what they found is over time, kids of that cohort had lower unemployment rates and lower academic achievement than other cohorts. And they're like, wait a minute, just boosting up self-esteem doesn't work. And they're doing it wrong, right? If you just tell your kid you're the best and they're not, mm-hmm. it doesn't link with reality. They go out with the broken sociometer. Oh, I could do anything. And then you go out, you can't actually do anything. You can't mm-hmm. be like a prima ballerina at like Carnegie Hall, like unless you know, are that kind of person who trains, you know, you can't do anything you want. Yeah. That's the reality. And thinking that you can artificially won't help you kind of match up, like, okay, how valuable am I to other people? How likely am I to get hired as a prima ballerina? Like, pretty low.
Yeah.
Like, pretty low. And actually, that is a better self-esteem than just if I go in thinking that I'm great with no data to back it up.
So part of this, if we have a friend with low self-esteem, saying you're amazing, you're great, they'll love you, isn't helpful in part, because it's not that believable necessarily, but B, because if they then go out and get negative social feedback, then it's going to be like, well, what the heck? Like, what's going on?
Yeah, yeah, because it's really hard because, you know, you might love your friend and telling them I love you and I think you're great is totally fine, right? Let's just say not to do that. But to say, oh, that guy rejected you for a date, that's okay. It's all that guy's fault. Mm-hmm. You're perfect. You're amazing. All you need to do is get out there and find someone who deserves you. Well, if that might be true. But if that person is doing something to
yeah.
actually like harm their chances or something that they need to work on, you can either A, like point that out in a loving, compassionate way, or point out the things that they're doing well that makes them attractive to other people, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, well, you know, you could work on your communication skills when you really, you know, need to assert your needs. But, like, you are such a generous, loving person that's going to attract the right people if you are looking for that. You know, so maybe not just, like, pump up their self-esteem artificially and make them, like, in a delusional way, but actually point out real qualities or behaviors or experiences that are positive for that person.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like, an easy analogy is just like if your friend is failing in their coursework or their career and you just say, but you're amazing, that's not going to be nearly as helpful as being like, can I teach you a skill that's relevant here? Or can
yeah,
I point out what you should go learn?
Yeah, or yeah. To teach them how to think about that stuff, think about, let's say, that one failure in a way that fits into an overall positive self-esteem or overall realistic self-esteem.
Yeah.
Yeah, you didn't do well in that last test. Or didn't get that job, didn't get that date. But think about all the other dates you got, or think about all the other good grades you got. What did you do well there? And yeah. It could apply next time, right?
Yeah. Another, so a cool intervention is called support groups. And this actually mirrored research that I was involved with before I came to Duke. But basically, in like in a support group, you support other people and you receive support. Mm-hmm. And oddly, what they found is that they said supporting peers had a positive impact on self-esteem, whereas receiving support from peers had a positive effect on self-efficacy. So the first part of this is not surprising to me because before I was at Mount Sinai and then Duke, I was at the Citadel Military College. And basically what happens there is that in your first year, you are a knob, you are kind of broken down so that the system, the institution can build you back up. You are being hazed, although it's officially not what is happening. You have to cut your hair really short. You have to walk on the road instead of the sidewalk. I mean, all sorts of things that kind of, you know, bash your self-esteem over the head. And I worked for a psychology lab that basically it doubled as like a service learning center. And so basically my PI would send freshman cadets and others out into service opportunities in the community. And what she found was that this raised self-esteem. So these people who are getting like dragged down on a daily basis, then they go out and they're helpful to other people. They're needed by other people and their self-esteem rises. And so one really great thing is if you have low self-esteem, maybe volunteer or like go into some service opportunities or help a friend with something. What surprises me though is that receiving support was associated with self-efficacy because I would think that going out and serving others would raise self-efficacy.
But interesting that could link well to the sociometer theory, because the sociometer theory is talking about self-esteem, about like how valuable you are to other people, mm-hmm. like, how much do you belong with the group, and you giving and volunteering and contributing to the community would actually raise self-esteem because you're like, oh, I'm valuable to other people, right? Totally. And receiving it might be great, like receiving it might boost other things, but that actually is in line. That actually supports the sociometer theory because it's like, this is a measure of how useful are we to other people.
Totally. I'm just surprised that self-efficacy rises when you receive support.
Mm-hmm.
Because I would think, if I need to receive support, I would think, oh, I have maybe lower self-efficacy because I'm needing to receive support.
I could see that if you receive support from other people, you can see yourself like able to do more stuff actually.
Yeah,
like I think that when we think about efficacy, which means like can we do stuff, how able are we to like get things done, peer support is really important, right? Like belonging to a group, getting that support is really important to like get our, you know, to achieve our goals, right? I'm very much saying this as a new mom, right? The feeling of just like independence and self-efficacy on myself doesn't seem realistic anymore. It's like we actually can do more with the people around us supporting us.
That's true. I suppose if I had to like fix something in my house and you came over and helped me, then suddenly I'd be like, oh, maybe I can kind of fix things. Like I've kind of learned how, or I can do more things with more people around, I guess.
That is definitely true, because the times that you go, oh no, I have to do some data analysis for a study. I can't do this. This is terrible. And you, like, I just watch your self-esteem just go in a pile of mush
no
in front of me.
It no longer exists. Yeah.
And then if we just like sit next to each other, I actually would just watch you do the data analysis on your own. So, you know, just that's just, you know, probably just evidence that someone, just knowing that someone's there to help you, could actually boost your own self-efficacy. Maybe not self-esteem, because you might just still be like, how valuable am I? That's a data analysis. I'm kidding. But
yeah, I mean, the problem is that the second you leave the room, I'm like, I just go right back to having mashed potato self-esteem and not being able to.
Hey, baby steps.
So we know that, I mean, I've talked a lot about how my self-esteem is pretty high in most domains, but in the career domain, not so much. Do you have any low domains of self-esteem, or what's been your personal experience with self-esteem?
Yeah, my self-esteem has always been high for academic and professional settings. Actually, uh-huh. For the first time, it's low now because now I'm like a new mom. I want to make a slight career change. yeah, I want to go from academic to industry settings. And I have no idea how valuable I am in that setting. No idea. I don't know how many people I'm competing against. I don't know what companies are out there that would want my skills. I don't know how good my skills are in those settings, right? So I'm, for the first time in a while, I felt like, oh no, my sociometer is like all over the place. It doesn't even know how to give me a reading. So I kind of default on the low, you know, like I'm just like, well, I'm just might be terrible. I might be useless. That's a bias. I don't even have information yet. So this is the time where I have like a question mark of my self-esteem and work. But in relationships and like especially romantically, it's been really interesting because have you watched Parks and Rec? Parks and Recreation?
I've watched like 10 episodes maybe.
Okay. So that show, if you haven't watched it, go watch it. But that show is about Leslie Knope, who's this who works in like in city government, and she works for the Parks Department, Parks and Rec, and she's so gung-ho about her job. She just loves it. She's obsessed. Played by Amy Poehler, who's amazing. And the interesting part is that there's a huge change between season one and season two. Season one is kind of like The Office, where she's so gung-ho that everyone in the office treats her like she's super annoying. Mm-hmm. They roll their eyes. They kind of treat her like a nerd. They reject her. But then, I don't know why they decided to do this, but then the change between season one and season two was that the character stayed the same, but that everyone else changed the way they reacted to her. So they like rolled their eyes, but they're like, but she's the best. And that changed the whole tone of the show, and the show kind of took off from there. And I feel like that's how I feel about myself in like the dating realm and friendships, where all my life growing up in New York and like the Gossip Girl world of Manhattan, private schools, I was like, I don't know. I just like people didn't seem to like me that much, or I got kind of bullied sometimes, and you know, people liked me. I had friends and I did have a boyfriend, but like I didn't walk into the room feeling like, oh yeah, people like me. Right? I was kind of a nerd. But then when I went to college, I don't know what happened. I feel like I was the exact same. Just people just react differently to me. Mm-hmm. They started to like me more. Like I got more interest from guys. And to this day, I don't know what happened. There's nothing about me that changed. And then it was a feedback loop. The more people liked me, the more outgoing I became. And I became so much more social after that. So I don't know what it is, but my self-esteem definitely did change in the sociometer theory, where I wasn't that valuable to people back in high school, middle school, but then college, suddenly I was a little bit cooler or something.
Well, I think there's a lesson in like finding the right environment for you. I mean, my self-esteem was very low in early high school. And I was just like, I would say that I had really awesome friends, like a core group of friends. They were great. But like the larger environment of people was just not very much like me. Mm-hmm. And it was actually when I started a politics club and was going to these like conventions in Ohio with these other politics nerds that I started to have much higher self-esteem, because I was around people who valued being nerdy, I guess, like being smart. Yeah. And we're also very college-driven. Like in high school, people called me college because I spent my free time on collegeport.com and princetonreview.com and everything. It was like a hobby. And I'd say like going to college, my self-esteem was still kind of low, in part because I didn't know what career group would be, what I would be desirable for. I just couldn't figure out what I should do for a living. But then as I went to New York and found more and more people like me, I mean, so that's just totally sociometer theory in action. It's like, we can talk about skills and personality traits changing, and that happened as well. But I just think finding the correct environment for me, like, massively raised my self-esteem.
Yeah, because you're moving from different groups that have different value for you, right? Like that different sense of belongingness. And if you find that could be a tip, you know, for intervening on low self-esteem, is find your group, find your tribe, find people who value you. And again, this is, if you have something that's broken, like a sociometer that's broken, right, your self-esteem is off, you might be loved by the people around you, mm-hmm. but for some reason you're not taking in that feedback. You're not taking in the data that people actually value you highly, right?
Right.
So, or on the other scale, if you value yourself too highly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Actually, the people who tend to value themselves too highly are like people with histrionic disorder, some and narcissism, right, and some forms of BPD. So different, I think, personality disorders kind of have that when the sociometer is broken the other way, where people just think that they're the shit, and they walk in and they're like, oh yeah, everyone's in love with me, mm-hmm. everyone likes me, right? And sometimes that works, but sometimes it really doesn't, right? You think of someone who just thinks too highly of themselves.
Well, sometimes they encounter unavoidable evidence that their reality is not matching.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so if you value yourself really highly and you're like, everybody here loves me, and then you're confronted by someone who is like, no one likes you, actually, then it's like, what an earth-shattering revelation yeah. that would be. And that could be pretty yeah. harmful.
That's when you see the flip from like too high to too low. So really, like, you should be somewhere in the middle, and it should be, it kind of should reflect reality. It should change based on domain, right? Like, you might have a higher self-esteem in one domain, like professional, and you might have a different one in, you know, like relationships and friendships. Your cat. And it also should vary, you know, in terms of who you hang out with, right? Some people are going to value you highly, and some people value less highly. So that's probably why self-esteem fluctuates on a day-to-day basis, because, you know, we overall, you could be a valuable person, but there might be different situations and groups of people and roles that you might be more or less valuable to others, or might at least feel more or less valuable to others.
Yeah, I think that's another reason therapy can be helpful, is to get a more accurate portrait of yourself and get to know yourself better. And in that way, you can find your tribe a little bit better. Mm-hmm. Who are people that value my attributes? Like, for instance, like a friend of mine just learned that she's diagnosed with autism, and that's like explaining a lot about her life, and it also mm-hmm. helps her navigate her social world a lot better. Both in terms of like, oh, I understand why I'm different, and maybe I can go find people who are more like me as well.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that self-esteem is such a big thing for you, right? There's some areas that I know that you feel really high self-esteem and some that are low. Have there been times where you have actively tried to improve your self-esteem, or?
Yeah, like, I mean, I mean, socially, I think I basically already told that story. I mean, I'll add that I went out and took a lot of social risks. I started being more outgoing, talking to more people, and that gave me more feedback about what traits people liked and what traits people didn't mm-hmm. like, and then I tried to somewhat change those things about myself. But I also think, like, if you sit at home and are afraid of meeting people, you're never going to get the feedback that, like, actually, maybe you're good at it. Maybe people do like you. And so I was, like, cripplingly shy when I was really, really young. Mm-hmm. And now I'm very outgoing and extroverted. And I think part of that is just, like, swallowing my fear and doing things. Mm-hmm. My work self-esteem is pretty low. With the exception of clinical work, I have pretty high self-esteem mm-hmm. there. And I think what's helped that is like some self-forgiveness around things I'm bad at mm-hmm. and also like not attempting to be what I'm not good at. Like if I tried to go be an academic, I think I would probably have low self-esteem because I would just not feel very competent in those areas. I wouldn't feel like a very desirable member of a research institution necessarily. But that's kind of, you know, that's a double-edged sword there because, again, like that could be the low self-esteem speaking instead of my objective characteristics. In my case, I don't think that's true, but I don't want to be like, oh, you know, if you have low self-esteem, like don't put yourself in positions that like where you think you won't be appreciated, because that could be any position. Do you know what I'm saying? Like if you're...
Yeah. It's like figuring out if your sociometer is broken. And what you need to do there is to go out, get a bunch of experiences, like try. Mm-hmm. I know that you try doing research a lot. You do. Mm-hmm. And then and then really being honest with yourself, and also like being honest with your loved ones about the things that you, you know, are good at and things that you're not good at. Yeah. And the things you're not good at, it's not just like accept that you're bad at it and accept a low self-esteem. You can actually work on those things. And that's what being, having the overinflated self-esteem is dangerous for. If you have a broken sociometer and think that you're amazing, you might actually miss out on areas that you need to work on and actually like build those skills in with, you know, just kind of a little bit more of an honest look at yourself. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I would say even with regards to research, my self-esteem has risen because, you know, I hate the data analysis part, but I'm not bad at other areas of it. I'm good at presenting my research. I mean, this is dumb, but I'm good at making beautiful slide decks. I'm good at the writing up of, you know, the intro and the discussion and whatnot. So there is a role for me within research, and I am developing parts of my brain that were very underdeveloped before. So it's higher than it was. It's just, I'm not going to kid myself about.
Yeah. And this is like one loved one to another. I mean, I wouldn't be like, no, Jacqueline, you know, every time we worked on research, I'm not like, Jacqueline, you're amazing. You're great at data analysis. Don't you say bad things about yourself. No, it's like, if you are joining a team, like you joined your team and what you have a pretty accurate sense of where how you're valuable, right? Mm-hmm. That's what, when you're just describing yourself, I'm like, oh, she has a pretty accurate sense of the qualities that make her attractive to other people. Yeah. That's why we're doing this podcast, because I know that you're good at speaking and presenting and discussing these topics. Do I come to you if I'm like, hey, I need someone to analyze this really complex data set and to run all of these models? No, I'm not going to go to you. I'm going to go to someone else, right? I'm being honest with you. You're at least you're not that interested in it enough to be so a valuable asset to like a data science.
Yes, you like, asked me that, I would endeavor. Instantly start right. crying.
Right, exactly. So I'm not going to tip for love one. I'm not going to just overinflate your self-esteem artificially. I'm going to be like, you're good at this stuff and you're less valuable at this stuff, but you can work on it if you wanted to.
Well, I think, but the other part of this is when maybe the cognitive restructuring might need to come in is if I said, I can't do data analysis, therefore I don't deserve to be in a PhD program.
Right.
Or therefore I'm no use to anybody. Like if you overvalue your deficits and basically say, this makes up the whole of me, this has way too much of an effect on my self-esteem, then that's where you'd go in and start thinking like, okay, well, it seems like you're diminishing some of your strengths.
Totally. That's a great example of how overgeneralizing can really break your sociometer. You're like, well, this one thing that I'm not good at means I'm a total failure and no one wants me. No, it has to be a little bit more complex than that.
Yeah.
The last tip we'll talk about is that mental health and self-esteem are really wrapped up together. Yeah. And something that to keep in mind is that if a person has a low mood, if they are not, if they're depressed, if they are in distress in some way, that's really going to bias their sociometer. They're going to either be super high or super low, most of the time super low, right? Because we know mood changes the way we think. Mm-hmm. So you're way more likely if you're down or depressed to not really take an honest look at yourself and take that one data point of like, I failed, I got rejected, I'm not good at data analysis, and making that the whole thing, making the negative the whole story. So I would say that if you are dealing with a loved one who is like kind of in a bad place and can't really is struggling with their self-esteem, I wouldn't go directly to like, no, but you're good at other things, because their mood is like a cloud. They can't see past it. I would try to boost their mood first. And this is what we would do with our patients, right? Like I wouldn't go straight to let's rework on your self-esteem. I would go to let's get you exercising. Let's get you back engaged with your friends and loved ones and the things that you like to do. Get your mood up so you could look at yourself clearly. And you can really have an honest look of things that you're not great at and all the other thing, all the your other strengths.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's why medication can be so great in tandem with therapy too, because the medication just lifts that cloud, but it doesn't do the deeper work that's necessary to maintain happiness. Another thing that I think is interesting, because this happens with a lot of my patients, is that part of the low self-esteem comes from fear of having certain emotions. And so I'll have a lot of patients who are very afraid of their own anger, for instance. And this means that they can be really afraid of putting themselves out there with other people or of experiencing or of letting other people see them and who they actually are, because they're spending so much time telling themselves, no, I'm not allowed to experience anger. I'm not allowed to show sadness to other people. And this might be because they had been punished in the past for something like this. Mm. And so, you know, maybe for some people, it can be an experience of like, wait a minute, when you are angry, I was like working with a client on this. It's like, the core belief is basically like my anger will push other people away. And it's like, okay, well, what do you do when you're angry? Like, oh, sometimes I yell a little bit. It's like, okay, do you hit people? Do you scream like a banshee? Do you insult them? No, no. Okay, well, then why can't you be yourself with other people? Why are you so scared of showing your true self and of showing your true emotions? So I just think that there sometimes self-esteem can be helped by some emotional work, some acceptance of like, I get to be a fully expressed person just like other people do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it just might be changing the way you express it so that you you improve your relationships, right? So you're not pushing people away.
Right.
People just say, oh, people don't like me because I'm angry. It's like, no, because it might be the yelling. So it's like learning how to express it in a way that still makes you valuable and keeps you in connection with others instead of pushing them away.
Okay, awesome. Well, Kibby, do you have any resources for us?
The ones I'll post are the ones I really like is I'm losing my train of thought. I'll link the two resources where you could read a little bit more about the sociometer theory by Dr. Mark Leary. I'll link a paper, The Nature and Function of Self-Esteem, Sociometer Theory by Mark Leary and Roy Baumeister. But also there's a book you can get on Amazon. It's called Selfhood, Identity, Esteem, Regulation, Social Psychology Series. And that's by Dr. Rick Hoyle and also Dr. Leary. Both of them are Duke professors. It's a little bit more of like, these are more like psych books, but if you really want to delve into the research and understanding of how psychologists are looking at self-esteem, these are great resources.
Awesome. Well, even though we don't advise just telling our friends that they're awesome, you know, for no good reason, if you would like to tell us we're awesome, please rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, and we'll see you next week.
By accessing this podcast, I acknowledge that the hosts of this podcast make no warranty, guarantee, or representation as to the accuracy or sufficiency of the information featured in this podcast. The information, opinions, and recommendations presented in this podcast are for general information only, and any reliance on the information provided in this podcast is done at your own risk. This podcast and any and all content or services available on or through this podcast are provided for general, non-commercial informational purposes only and do not constitute the practice of medical or any other professional judgment, advice, diagnosis, or treatment and should not be considered or used as a substitute for the independent professional judgment, advice, diagnosis, or treatment of a duly licensed and qualified healthcare provider. In case of a medical emergency, you should immediately call 911. The hosts do not endorse, approve, recommend, or certify any information, product, process, service, or organization presented or mentioned in this podcast, and information from this podcast should not be referenced in any way to imply such approval or endorsement.